Dr. Robert C. Newman, Professor of New Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
I try and give it a start this morning by looking at the subject, the immortality passages in the book of Job. The immortality passages in the book of Job. Actually, what I want to do is not only look at those passages in the book of Job, but also under each section, compare them with other scriptures found elsewhere in the Old Testament. In introducing this subject, I'd like to point out, of course, that there is a considerable difference of opinion on the immortality passages in the Old Testament. We have groups of people who claim to be Christian who do not believe that there is any such thing as immortality in the sense that anybody continues to exist beyond death, but rather that people go out of existence when they die and then are recreated, so to speak, when they come back. There are other people who believe that when people go out of existence, they stay out of existence. And this would be liberal theologians of various sorts. We do want to make a distinction at the beginning of our talk here between two different concepts. The concept of the evolution of religion, which is held very commonly in liberal circles, and the concept of progressive revelation, which is, I believe, a teaching of Scripture. Progressive revelation and evolution of religion. In the view of evolution of religion, it is claimed that man gradually comes to a better and better idea of what reality is like as time goes on, and that early men believed that there were spirits everywhere that were the spirits of the waters and the streams and the spirits of the trees and the spirits of the rocks and that sort of thing. And this sort of view was called animism, and you may still find this among certain tribes which do not have technology that we have today, but which are still living. This is then felt to have developed at some time in history into a view in which these spirits came to be recognized as some of them being much greater than others, and these greater ones being raised to a level of gods or something of that sort. And then we would come to what would be called polytheism, many gods, and the person would worship these different gods, a number of the different gods. And we see such a variety of religion in a number of varieties of Hinduism today, and certainly was a very common view in the period around New Testament times in the Roman Empire, among the Greeks, etc. It's been a very common variety of religion, polytheism. It's felt then that in certain circles, this view was developed further on until it became felt that there should only be one god worshipped, even though many gods existed. And this is the view called henotheism. Henotheism, many gods, worship only one. And finally, monotheism, only one god. It's been alleged by liberals that we see the remnants of this kind of development in the religion of Israel. And that's commonly brought forward then in liberal works on the Old Testament. And this would be an example of what we would call evolution of religion. The claim would be not that we're getting revelation from God in the objective way, but that men are groping around and trying to find out how things really are. And as their ideas get better and better, they head more towards more advanced ideas of the nature of reality and get away from some of the earlier superstitions. Now, some liberals, they would not call themselves Christians at all, would say that one has still not reached the highest pinnacle here because there's one more logical step beyond here, and that's atheism. No God. Now, you start with many and work up until you've got none. Well, liberals would differ on that. Some would feel there is one God, some would feel or not. But this idea is what we call evolution of religion. In this view, people who believed these earlier things were wrong. But as their ideas got better, they got towards ideas that were more accurate and gradually reached the truth, whatever the truth is thought to be by these men. We need to contrast that very strongly with the idea of progressive revelation, which I would understand to be the biblical teaching, in which in the earlier materials in the Bible, we do not have as much information about the nature of God and the nature of man and the nature of history, where history is going, what God is doing in history, as we do in later revelation. If we had as clear a picture in the beginning, it would not be clear why you'd have any more revelation. We'd stop. But God has chosen to continue on, and we find in Scripture indications that some of the earlier people in the history of revelation, in the history of redemption, did not understand some of the things that we should be able to understand now. You remember the passage in the wrong book, 2 Peter, I believe it is, where the writer says that the prophets searched to see what this was about the redemption that was coming. And it was revealed to them that they were not going to understand it. but rather that those to whom the redemption would come would be the ones that these prophecies were intended for. So the prophets of the Old Testament wrote certain things they did not understand fully themselves, and indicates to us both that this material is from God, and need not be that the prophet thoroughly understand it, but also shows us a development in understanding of these things as revelation goes on. So we do want to distinguish these two things, because it is in this area of immortality that we will see, as in many other areas, a clash between these two viewpoints. The claim on the one hand that the early parts of the Bible do not teach immortality or resurrection or judgment or something of that sort, all in the area of immortality. And the claim on the other hand that, yes, there are hints of them, but it is not as clear in the earlier material and gradually becomes clearer. And so the attempt would then have to be to see whether, on the one hand, as the people who hold evolution or religion would believe, that there are actually contradictions between the earlier and later material, and on the other hand, whether we have rather a gradual development of more and more information about these things. I don't know whether I can think of a good illustration to clarify the distinction between these two things. Perhaps we can think in history of the discovery of America. You perhaps were taught in elementary school that Columbus discovered America. When we get to junior high school, you discover that the Leif Erikson discovered America. And when you get into college, you may hear that a fellow picked up some stone down in Georgia and found some Hebrew writing on it. And maybe the Hebrews were over here early. The Mormons would say, ha, we told you all the time. And then suddenly you realize the Indians have been here all the time. And so Columbus didn't really discover America. Well, somebody might say that's like evolution of religion. Your idea is gradually getting better and better as time goes on. Well, there's a sense in which that's true and a sense in which that's false. Because probably the teachers who taught you that Columbus discovered America in elementary school were aware of Leif Erikson. He's been known for a long time. But they did not want to complicate the situation too much at first. They wanted to explain to you how it is that we got here and how it is that people in the Western Hemisphere came to come here. And that is because of Columbus, not primarily because of Leif Erikson. Leif Erikson's discoveries were noted later, and they were not the driving force that led to the colonization of the Western Hemisphere, but rather Columbus' discoveries and then the follow-up by other men at that time really led to it. So there's a sense in which Columbus discovered America for Western civilization, even though these other men had done some work earlier. He didn't discover it for the Indians. They had certainly been here. So I'm not sure that illustration is too helpful, but the point there is that from a teacher's point of view, that's no evolution of religion. He knew what the situation was, but starts out by giving you a simpler overview and then gradually giving you the complexities involved in it. And that's my understanding of what God has done here. He's given you a simple overview and then gradually filled in certain details. And I think there are a number of areas in which this is so. One of them, of course, would be the Trinitarian nature of God, an area that is not made as clear in the Old Testament, though there are hints of it. And another one would be the idea that the Messiah who would finally come is God himself. Since the Trinity is not made as clear in the Old Testament, that's not made quite as clear. It was clear enough for certain people to notice it, but clear enough for other people to claim it wasn't there, and unclear enough that others could claim it's not there. And that's my suggestion here, that in this immortality material, we will see materials that I think you'll find agree with the rest of the Old Testament and that agree with the New Testament, but they're often not as detailed and worked out as thoroughly. Well, after all of that, I'd like to get into the first of four topics then relating to immortality. And that would be, first of all, the continued existence of the individual beyond death. Secondly, Sheol, the place of the dead. Thirdly, the resurrection. And fourth, judgment beyond. Those four areas. And in each of these areas, basically, we'll try to look at some passages in Job first, and then we'll look at other materials elsewhere in the Old Testament. And in some ways, we'll see that Job does not give us as much detail in some of these areas, but yet I think we'll see that there's not a real contradiction in these things. So the first topic, then, we'd like to look at in connection with immortality is the continued existence of the individual beyond death. The continued existence of the individual beyond death. I've picked out about five or six passages out of Job for some fairly detailed translation, and I've scattered them around under these various topics, though they overlap to a certain extent. So the two I've picked to discuss here in connection with the continued existence of the individual beyond death are these marked on your sheet. Job 3, verses 13 to 19, and Job 14, verses 7 through 15. The book of Job, now you remember, deals with a problem of why those who are righteous among men, that is, compared with other men, those who are righteous among men, suffer. How can that problem be dealt with? Job gets a first-hand opportunity to find out that it does happen, and that when one suffers, it becomes very hard to think carefully and think through things and consider them all. He gets a chance to see his friends are all around him, and banquet with him, no doubt, and such things when he's doing well. They all come back very quickly when he recovers. But when he's suffering, they're ready to throw their stones at him, too, and say, well, this just shows that you're really a secret sinner. Job, of course, knows that's wrong. He knows that at least he's not intentionally hiding anything. He knows he's a sinner, but he knows that as far as he can tell, he's no worse sinner than the people around him, and as far as he can tell, rather more righteous in many ways, and can't understand why it is that God then allows these things to happen. He gradually comes, I think, to an understanding of that as the book goes on. You've got to remember, Job is not familiar with the activities in heaven that take place in chapters 1 and 2. And we have then a great deal in Job's speeches of his lamentation regarding his approaching death and what he sees in it and what God has done to him. He knows God is in control of history. There are a lot of Christians that seem to not realize that, but Job could. Job knew that although all these disasters had come, God finally had allowed them to come and was in control, and therefore God must have a reason for it, and he was trying to figure out what it is and show God that he did not deserve these things. Well, the passages I've chosen are by and large Job's statements rather than the statements of his three friends. And reason for that, of course, would be the three friends are spoken of in the end of the book as not having said the things that are right about God. Now, they do say a lot of things that are right about God, but we'd have to really go through the rest of the scripture and compare with what they say to figure out which things they said are right and which aren't, because God explicitly says they have not spoken to me the thing that is right. So we'll be using Job's statements rather than the statements of his three friends. Well, then, in Job 3, we have part of Job's lamentation regarding his desire for death to relieve him of the great afflictions that he is in. Read the passage that he has, of course, lost all his possessions, and he's lost his children, and his wife seems, in a sense, to have turned against him, or at least to recommend that he do something which he feels he cannot possibly do and remain faithful to God. And so he begins chapter 3 with cursing the day he was born. And then as we come into our section, verse 13, he says, now I would have laid down and been at peace. Then I would have slept and been at rest with kings and counselors of the earth, the builders of waste places for themselves, or with princes having gold, the ones who have filled their houses with silver, or like a hidden miscarriage I would not have been, like children who have not seen the light. There the wicked cease from turmoil, and there the exhausted rest from work. Together the prisoners are at ease. They do not hear the voice of the slave driver. Small or great, here he is, and the slave is freed from his master. So Job is talking about death here. See from the whole context of this around, he laments that he was ever born, and then he laments that he did not die in his mother's womb, or that he did not die as soon as he came out, and all of these things. And then he tells what would have been the situation if he had died, and he speaks of laying down and being at rest, and being with all of these rich, wealthy, and powerful people who have died, the kings, the counselors of the earth, the builder of these, says, waste places. I think the idea is they're now waste, but they were once fine palaces and such things. The builder of all the fine ruins that he apparently could see even at that early time in history. That he would have gone to join them. And then in verse 16 he says, or like a hidden miscarriage, I would not have been. I would not have been. And that is a very interesting phrase, because we'll see this later in other passages in Job. And I think we need to see that it does not indicate necessarily the complete non-existence of a person. He says if he had not come to birth, even though his body is already formed and He still can call himself I would not have been like children who have not seen the light. But then goes on to speak of these people resting. The figures that that Job has chosen seem to suggest these people exist. The kings, the counselors, etc., are there resting? The wicked are there, ceasing from their turmoil, exhausted are resting. The prisoners are at ease. They don't hear the voice of the slave master, driver, small or great. Here he is, you see. Doesn't say small and great, he no longer exists. Something like that. Small and great, here he is. He's picturing death, the condition of death. He is there. He's still he. Job says, I would have slept. Again, using the pronoun I as though there's a personal existence. He pictures it like sleeping. It seems to be, to him, a good analogy. We'll need to see why it's a good, in what way it's a good analogy. Whether it means that the soul has no consciousness or not. Does the soul have no consciousness when we sleep? We dream when we sleep. But there's some different things when you're asleep. But there does seem to be an analogy here. A person is resting, but still mentioned as a person, still uses the pronouns I, gives the names of these different persons, kings, counselors, slaves, etc. They're there, but they're not doing what they were doing. But they're there. And then it uses this phrase, like a hidden experience, I would not have been. And we might take that, I would not have existed at all. But I think the thrust is more, I would not have had my life. I would not be in a living condition. I would not have been in that sense. We'll have to look at that more. But I think there's a definite indication by the whole thrust of the figures of speech used here that the being exists and has a personality and what shall we say, an individuality, but he's not doing the things that he had previously been doing. Job chapter 14 is another passage that seems to deal with the same area. There is hope for a tree, if it has been cut down, that again it will sprout. Most trees, as any person who has tried to get a tree out of his yard will be aware, if you cut it down, that is not the end, usually. Usually, unless you completely uproot the thing, you will have the tree back again. There is hope for a tree, if it's been cut down, that again it will sprout, and its shoot will not give up. Shoot will not give up. Even if its rootstock grows old in the earth, and its stump dies in the dust, from a scent of water, it will sprout and make a bough like a young shoot. Here, perhaps even speaking of a tree that might be dormant because of lack of water, something of that sort. Yet, when water is available, at least certain types of trees will go on ahead and grow more roots and will sprout out again. So this is a picture given of a tree that's been cut down and sprouts again. A tree that, even though it looks like the stump is now rotting, it puts out new shoots again when the water is available. Now, the King James Version here says, but, in verse 10, 14:10, but. But the Hebrew says, but, connected in Hebrew. It's used for all kinds of things. It's translated and most of the time in Scripture, and, just and. But it's used a lot more than and is in English. Now, this is even used to start books. In the New Testament, whereas we don't use and to start sentences very often. So this just kind of gets you started again, and we translate it sometimes and, sometimes but, sometimes so, then, all sorts of things. You go through a concordance and see how any version of the Old Testament in English is translated, and you'll see a huge variety of ways of translating it. It does not tell you the logical relationship between what follows and what precedes. It just tells you there's some kind of connection. It's intending to connect the two in some way. And in Hebrew poetry, then, you have got to figure out what the connective is. If you get in trying to translate the Proverbs, for instance, you've got to translate both halves of a proverb and then see whether the two halves are parallel to each other or whether they're in antithesis to each other. Here's a pile of antithetical ones in chapter 13. A wicked messenger falls into mischief, but a faithful ambassador is help. Every prudent man deals with knowledge, but a fool lays open his folly. The desire accomplished is sweet to the soul, but is abomination to fools to depart from evil. You look in passages like this where all of these buts, they're ands. And how do you decide to put a but in for English? You see that the one thrust is in contrast to the other. And example of a two-line proverb that the two ideas are parallel to each other. 14:19, the evil bow before the good and the wicked at the gates of the righteous. There's parallelism. The evil bow before the good and the wicked, parallel to evil, at the gates, bow at the gates of the righteous. Well, how do you know to put an and there instead of a but? Because the two ideas are parallel to each other rather than contrasted to each other. So what we've got to figure out in a passage like this is what is stated before this in parallel or in contrast to what is going on here? And that has been on the tricky side. We've looked at a tree, and it's cut down, and it will resprout. Even though its stump rots, it will resprout when the conditions are right. Then he says, a man dies, and he disappears, and he becomes feeble. There's some range of meaning in that word. A man expires, and where is he? Doesn't tell you exactly. It may sound like he's gone forever, but we've got to continue on with the context. Waters disappear from the sea, he says. There's something that seems to be rather parallel to verse 10, really. Waters disappear from the sea, and a stream drains off or dries up. You can't see them anymore. There was the water, perhaps a little pond or something, and it evaporates. You don't see it anymore. Man disappears. He dies and he disappears. Don't know whether he's thinking that the life in the man disappears just when you lay him in a tomb, or if you come back 200 years later, the man himself, the body itself has disappeared. Doesn't say exactly. But there's certainly some kind of parallelism between 10 and 11. And then, in verse 12, he says, a man lies down and does not arise. Until the heavens are no more, they will not awake, nor be stirred up from their sleep. That might sound like we've got a contrast with a tree. That contrast with a tree sounds at first like that, that the tree sprouts up again. The man, however, when he disappears, you might say, well, he's like the water, disappears, and doesn't come back. But, of course, the water does come back. The water rains down later. So the water disappearing is not a complete disappearance of this thing. And you find throughout the book of Job reference to the fact that the clouds have the water in them and they dump it back on the earth and things of that sort. And now, although verse 12 sounds like man does not arise, it does say until the heavens be no more. That could mean never. It could be a figure of speech for never, but it might not be. It might mean that the resurrection or whatever there's going to be is way off in the future and has something to do with a change in the whole nature of created reality. Well, at that point, if you stopped at 12, it would still seem extremely ambiguous, and one might say very well, Job does not seem to have any idea of continued existence beyond death, at least in this particular passage. The tree shoots up again, but man dies and disappears, like the water that disappears. Man lies down and doesn't arise until the heavens are no more. But, verse 13, if only you would hide me in Sheol, says Job to God. You hide me in Sheol. Conceal me until your anger turns away. Now there, he's saying something about a limited time. Hide me, conceal me until your anger turns back. Well, he might say, he's being pessimistic. He thinks it'll never turn back, and so he just wants to get out of the whole thing. But then he says, set a specific time for me and remember me. If a man dies, will he live? All the days of my service, I will wait till my relief comes. Call, and I myself will answer you. You will long for the work of your hands. So he's been talking about himself all through something. He's definitely going down into death. He's being hidden, and yet God is going to remember him later, call him later. And in fact, there seems to be a continuation of the individual all through this viewed situation of going down into death, being hidden in Sheol. This is my suggestion, that there's an analogy from the plant kingdom and from the mineral kingdom, if you like, with water, meteorology, of a disappearance of something which does not cease to exist and which comes back. The tree which wiped out, so to speak, as far as you can see it above ground, yet sprouts. The water which disappears, and he doesn't here say this, but elsewhere rather clear in Job that they knew about it, that it's going into the clouds and it comes back down again. Suggestion, I don't know how much he knew, but he at least is hinting at things which seem to indicate a continued existence. Let's look at a few other passages elsewhere in the Old Testament. My suggestion here in Job would be that one is not beat over the head with the idea of continued existence after death, although he does keep using the personal pronoun when he is picturing himself as dead, I would be resting with so-and-so. They are there. You will call to me and I will answer, even see if that is in death in some way. We're not yet getting on to the resurrection material, although I think this is a passage that points in that direction. Let's look elsewhere in the Old Testament. 2 Samuel 12:23 is a passage one can argue about, certainly, but seems to imply a continued existence of persons beyond death. I don't think you can press this too hard, but I think it points that way. 2 Samuel 12:23. David has committed the sin of Bathsheba. A child has been born. Nathan has come and convicted him of his sin and has told him the child will die. And now the child has died. David had been fasting and covered with sackcloth and ashes, weeping, etc., for the child while he was alive. And now the servants are afraid to tell him that he's been killed, that the child has died, because they're afraid that David will kill himself or do something of that variety. But finally, David realizes from their whispering to each other over in the corner that something of the sort must have happened and asks them and finds out. And then it says in verse 20, they said, he's dead. Then David arose from the earth, washed and anointed himself, changed his clothes, came into the house of the Lord and worshipped. Then he came to his own house and had food set before him. And the servants said to him, what is this that you've done? You fasted and wept for the child while he was alive, but when the child was dead, you rose up and ate bread. Different situation from what is common. Common, the person perhaps might be weeping and such while the child is living, but when the child has died, they have no hope. They begin to cry and weep inconsolably. Very common. But he doesn't do that, does he? Almost the opposite. And he says, but now he's dead, why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he shall not return to me. Now, this certainly fits very well in the biblical materials with the idea that once a person has passed beyond this life, there's nothing we can do about it, and we will go to see them. We will go to the place where they are. They will continue to exist, but they aren't coming back here alive. Now, it's possibly consistent with some kind of a Stoic view, but he does not seem to feel, well, he's going to the grave, and I'll go to the grave, something like that. The impression you get that he has washed himself and anointed himself is that the mourning is over, that there's something beyond. I will go to him, he says again. He again uses his personal pronoun for a person which, in a non-survival view, would not exist anymore. A bit hard to know why he would use that kind of a construction. I'll go to him. He might say, he is not anymore. He ceased to exist. Why should I bother to worry about him or something like that? He doesn't say this. He says, I'll go to him. As I say, you can say that's a poetic way of saying, you know, it's over or something. But he does say, I will go to him, and simplest understanding is he will go somewhere where the child is. Now, the second Samuel one is possible to avoid, I think, but I think the simplest understanding of language is that the personality is still existing, so you can still use he, I, he, etc. Ezekiel 32:31, I'd like to look at, a rather interesting section. Ezekiel chapter 32, it's a long lamentation for Pharaoh, king of Egypt, disaster that's going to come upon him. It says in verse 11, the sword of the king of Babylon will come upon you. By the sword of the mighty I will cause your multitude to fall, the terrible of the nations, all of them. They shall spoil the pomp of Egypt. All the multitude shall be destroyed, etc. And then in verse 18, son of man, wail for the multitude of Egypt and cast them down, even her and the daughters of the famous nations, to the nether parts of the earth with those that go down to the pit. And then begins a long discussion of, I think, Sheol, of the place that departed dead. Let me read a few sections of it. Whom do you pass in beauty? Verse 19. Go down and be laid with the uncircumcised. This is Ezekiel 32. They shall fall in the midst of them that are slain by the sword. Delivered to the sword, draw her and all her multitudes. The strong among the mighty shall speak to them out of the midst of Sheol, from with them that help them. They are going down. They lie uncircumcised, slain by the sword. Asher, Assyria, says, is there with all her company. Her graves are about him. All of them are slain, fallen by the sword. Verse 24, there is Elam, one of the provinces in Mesopotamia, with all her multitude about her grave. All of them slain, fallen by the sword. There is Meshech, Tubal, all her multitude, verse 26. And verse 29, there is Edom, her kings and all her princes, all those that are laid, those that are slain by the sword. They shall lie with the uncircumcised, go down to the pit. and the Sidonians are mentioned in verse 30. And then verse 31, the verse we're after, Pharaoh shall see them and shall be comforted over all his multitude, even Pharaoh and all the army slain by the sword, says the Lord God. The impression you seem to get here is that Pharaoh is going down to death with all his army, but when he gets there, he will see all of these other great armies down there, and he will reap at least a little satisfaction from that. He will be among the dead, among some of these other great kingdoms that have been before him, and reap some satisfaction. But notice the impression given here then is that Pharaoh, dead, will see these multitudes. Seems to imply, again, a continuation of personal existence beyond death, or in death. Continuation of personal existence. Pharaoh and his army, the slain, shall soon be satisfied. Well, there are a couple other passages of this variety. Ecclesiastes 12:7, the remark where about the Spirit returning to God who gave it. The Spirit returning to God who gave it. This would perhaps by those who like to deny continued existence after death, they would just say it's the breath. The breath will return to God who gave it. That's kind of a weak understanding of the passage, but the way I think you would find it handled by perhaps Jehovah's Witnesses attempt to just make the Spirit over into breath. That's Ecclesiastes 12:7. The dust shall return to the earth as it was, and the Spirit shall return to God who gave it. But it is consistent with what we've said so far, that there's some part of man that has a personality that continues to exist beyond death. That's my suggestion for that passage. It's again a passage that need not be understood that way, but it's consistent with the other two passages that we've looked at elsewhere in the Old Testament. David's son, still spoken of as he, even though he's dead. Pharaoh, still doing something. He's still seeing these around him in Sheol. The Spirit, returning to God who gave it. I'd like to look very quickly at a very familiar passage, Psalm 23, and suggest it has something to do with death and continued existence beyond death. Psalm 23, of course, everyone kind of knows by heart, but better get it out and look at it here anyway. Seems to deal with two figures for the relation of a believer to God. The first figure is a shepherd, to a sheep. God is a shepherd, the believer is the sheep. Carries that through. Some people have attempted to work that through the whole psalm, but you begin to get yourself in serious trouble near the end of the psalm. The idea of preparing a table, sheep don't eat off tables. The idea of anointing one's head with oil is not impossible for sheep, because oil is used to help wounds and stuff. But this does not seem to say anything about wounds. And the anointing of a head with oil is a very common activity, not today certainly, but was very common then as a special honor given to a guest at a meal. And goodness and mercy pursuing me, the phrase used there is a phrase used, though it's not necessarily only for this, is a phrase that is often used for servants who would follow a person around to make sure he had everything he wanted. And dwelling in the house of a person would again sound like house guest, unless one takes the house of the Lord as being the temple. As far as we know, David never lived in the temple. This is speaking about living, dwelling in this place. My impression is that the figure is changed in the psalm from a shepherd to a sheep figure, God the shepherd, the believer the sheep, to a host guest figure at the end of the psalm. And the host is God, and the guest is a believer. The believer is pictured as a person who is a house guest of someone else. And so he receives the table prepared for him, he's fed there, he lives there, dwells there, he has his head anointed, he has his cup filled to overflowing, and he has servants to wait on him, which are here goodness and mercy, and he dwells. This is a different kind of house guest. This is a guest that dwells there for his whole life. He moves in with his host and lives there the rest of his life. That's the picture of the house guest. Why is there a change? Why is there a change in the figure in the middle of a psalm like that? Well, it's very interesting. The picture of the shepherd starts out sometime in the daytime. The sheep is out there. He lies down, which in green pastures. He's led beside the waters. He protects him. He leads him in the right paths and all of these things. And then you seem to see the shepherd being leading the sheep home, going down perhaps through a valley where there's very deep shadow, which of course would be true only late in the afternoon when you get the shadows falling. Of course, it would be true early in the morning. But if there's some kind of a time scale going on here, you start out in the daytime, the sheep are going along and being fed and treated, cared for and all that sort of stuff. And now you see them going home, the deep shadows falling, and they're going through the valley. But suddenly when they get home, they aren't sheep anymore. The house guests. My suggestion is that the valley of the death shadow here, and the whole purpose of bringing in death shadow, is to show you that the shadow itself is death. And that the person doesn't even fear when he goes through death, because God is protecting him, and because God has something beyond it, even a new state. He's no longer now a sheep who has to be herded around and watched out for so much. He's now a guest at the house and spends the rest of his time, which is not pointed out here, but it's forever, even though the KJV reads forever. But for length of days, not olam, for length of days. And my understanding for why that's used is that it's part of the figure. A person who lives the rest of his life in a person's house, a lifelong house guest. See, he's trying to stick to the figure, but what it represents is forever. You're looking at one day in the life of a sheep, but then when you get into the house guest, it's a lifelong house guest. So contrasting short, long, and suggesting that the forever there, which a King James Version put in, is a correct understanding of what was intended, but there's slight cheating on the actual wording. Suggestion here, which makes very good sense out of the figures used, and explains why the figure changes, why it changes where it does, and seems to point to a chronological sequence through the psalm. My suggestion is that points also to a continued existence beyond death, though it's just hinted at. Well, we've got to charge onward here, and I'd like to look next then at what Roman numeral 3, but just a second topic in our discussion, Sheol, the place of the dead. Let me read you quickly from the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament, the part of the article on Hades, because Hades, we'll find the word Hades in the New Testament is closely related to Sheol, and you'll get a look at the liberal view of the development of religion in this particular aspect. In the ancient Greek translation of the Old Testament, Hades is almost always a rendering of Sheol. In the Old Testament, says the writer, as well as liberal, this signifies the dark realm of the dead, which is set beneath the ocean, and which consigns all men indiscriminately behind its portals to an eternal, shadowy existence. This Old Testament Sheol idea is an essential agreement with the conception of the future world found in popular Babylonian belief. After the exile, now you reach a second stage. The first stage is a place down under the ocean where people stay forever after they die. That's their view of the ancient view. And the passages he quotes there are out of Job, Psalm, and Ecclesiastes. So this particular writer, anyway, Jeremias, understands that this must be the old view and found in these books. After the exile, this notion went through a sequence of incisive changes. First, belief in the resurrection resulted in a temporal limitation of the sojourn in the underworld for the souls of those to be resurrected. It says, a new belief arose in resurrection, and that had to then cut off the eternal length of time in Sheol and not the finite length of time. The earliest instance of this idea being found in Isaiah 26:19. Secondly, under the influence of Persian and Hellenistic ideas concerning retribution after death, the belief arose that the righteous and the godless would have very different fates, and we thus see the development of the idea of spatial separation in the underworld. The first instance being found in Ethiopian Enoch, number 22. According to Josephus, the Pharisees held this view. And then he goes on with the penetration into Palestine and the belief in immortality led to the idea that the souls of the righteous proceed at once to heavenly bliss after death, there to await their resurrection. So there you get kind of a liberal idea, an eternal Sheol, and then the idea of a resurrection makes it a finite length of Sheol for those who get resurrected, and then the idea of a judgment coming in, and then later the idea of immortality sends these people who die immediately to heaven in some way. So this is a liberal attempt to reconstruct this thing on an evolution of religion point of view. And we suggested already that a couple remarks in Job point to a limitation of time in Sheol, even though that's the passage from which these fellows have been quoting the old ideas of Sheol. So what we're really going to have to do is take a word study of the word Sheol and see what is actually there in Scripture on the thing and see whether it fits anything like this kind of a pattern suggested by Jeremias and very common liberal understanding. So we will want to take a word study in it, Hebrew word Sheol. It's a word that occurs 65 times in the Hebrew Old Testament, Sheol. And the Greek Old Testament, the Septuagint translation of the Old Testament, made before the time of Christ, translates us most of the time by the word Hades. This word etymologically, you go back and see what, you break it into pieces, see what the pieces mean, means not seen, unseen. Ah, you do. Ah, not, and you do from the verb horao, to see. So the unseen realm, and of course had a usage in Greek thinking of the place of the dead. Other times, there are four times this is not translated by Hades, and then where you can see exactly what the author was doing, where he's not paraphrasing heavily enough that you can't figure out what he's doing exactly, the word is usually translated by the word death, death, thanatos. So the author certainly had the idea that what we're looking at here is something to do with death and something to do with the unseen part about death, not just stuck in a, not just stuck in a casket somewhere, unseen part about death. The Latin Vulgate, which was made, of course, several centuries after the time of Christ, uses the word infernum. And when one looks at that, one gets the idea of a place of fire from the word inferno, etc., which means a place of fire or something of that sort in English. But if you actually look up the Latin, you find it doesn't mean that at all. It means the lower area, something down. And the word inferno in English has got the fire idea because the pictures of hell, particularly as we would see in Dante's Inferno and such, involve fire. And so the word itself doesn't mean anything about that, but it just happens that it has picked up that idea in English. So the lower region, the place of the dead, again. So both these translators, the unknown translators of the Greek Old Testament before the time of Christ, and the known translator, Jerome, several centuries after Christ, understood that this word, Sheol, meant the place of the dead. Well, what we'd like to do, then, is compare Job and other Old Testament passages in regard to what they teach about Sheol. What information do they give us about the place? And we'll compare it under these several headings, which I think I've got marked here. Location, inhabitants, and conditions there. The first thing is the location. What does Job have to say about the location of Sheol? Well, he uses the term down, Job 7:9. As the cloud is consumed and vanishes, so he that goes down to Sheol shall come up no more. 11:8. Same idea, down. This is not Job talking here, however. Talking about the nature of God and how can you figure out. He says it's as high as heaven. What do you know? Deeper than Sheol. What can you know? So a picture of depth, a picture of down. And you'll find as you go through other biblical materials that this phrase down is used a great deal. Used a great deal. And that, of course, led some people to think that if you went down a deep cave, you might accidentally get into the place or something of that sort. And that has been a fairly common idea. But I think it's a little more subtle than that, and not get time to go into it today. But my feeling is that it is actually somewhat like the situation with heaven, which is spoken of quite consistently as up, and yet we find out that it's more complicated than that, that it's some kind of invisible realm around us in some way. And that the terms up and down are used just to give some direction on how to get there. I mean, almost whenever you talk about any kind of spatial things, you have to use some kind of term. Go there, or go over, or up, or, you know, in fact, we often use the idea you see in hymns of going over Jordan, for instance, meaning to go into the eternal state or something like that. And you look at all kinds of other passages in the Bible where the phrase, where Sheol is used. Genesis 37:5 would be a good example. Jacob, speaking of mourning for his son, says, I will go down to my son Joseph mourning into Sheol. This sort of idea of going down is a very common phrase to be used in connection with it. Now, some have taken Amos 9:2, as a evidence that it was felt to be an actual hole down somewhere under the ground because of a reference to digging in Amos 9:2. Starting with the first verse of the chapter, Amos says, I saw the Lord standing by the altar, and he said, smite the lintel of the door, that the posts may shake, cut them in head, all of them, and I will slay the last of them with the sword. He that flees of them shall not flee away. He that escapes of them shall not be delivered. Though they dig into Sheol, thence shall my hand take them. Though they climb up to heaven, thence will I bring them down. That's been taken by some to indicate that if you dig a deep enough hole, you'll get down there. Something like that. I'm not sure whether it says that or not. It does use Sheol, however, for the idea of something that's very deep. And if you could even get there, God would get you. And if you could even get up to heaven, God would bring you back. And whether it's pointing to something that's an actual place, an actual hole under the ground, I think can be seriously questioned, particularly in view of the fact that Jonah, just a couple pages over, in chapter 2, verse 2, seems to speak of himself as being in Sheol while he is inside the fish. Jonah prayed to the Lord his God out of the fish's belly, it says in Jonah chapter 2, verse 1 and verse 2, and I said, I cried by reason of my affliction to the Lord, and he heard me. Out of the belly of Sheol cried I, and you heard my voice. Jonah prayed out of the fish's belly, and he says, out of the belly of Sheol I cried. My suggestion there, at least, is that it's a more complicated idea, that there may be a sense in which his body is in the fish, but something else about him is in some other place, Sheol. And that place, therefore, is not a place in our sense that we can walk there somewhere. Probably can't even dig there in any way, but that God is giving you a hyperbole. You Israelites are not going to escape this punishment. If you could climb to heaven, I'd bring you back. If you dig to Sheol, I'd bring you up from there. Suggestion, the physical location of it is something we can't get to by walking or digging, my suggestion. It is pictured as hidden, of course, and that's seen in Job and many other places. Job 14:13, which we had read earlier, hide me in Sheol, he says to God. Yet he also says that nobody can hide in Sheol from God in 26:6. So the location is pictured as down, and yet there's something more complicated about it. My suggestion would be it's not something you can get to by walking or climbing or digging. That you might be able to get there by committing suicide, but it's not a place you can get to bodily. What about the inhabitants? Like the inhabitants of Sheol. Well, this is interesting. Job points out that the wicked are there. Job 24:19. Drought and heat consume the snow waters. So Sheol, those who have sinned. So Sheol, those who have sinned. So those who have sinned are in Sheol. And that's carried elsewhere in Scripture. Psalm 9:17, for instance, has the same idea. Psalm 9:17, very famous passage. The wicked shall be turned into Sheol, all the nations that forget God. Wicked shall be turned into Sheol, all the nations forget God. So the Bible, both Job and elsewhere, clear. The wicked, Sheol. But the righteous are in Sheol also. The righteous are in Sheol also. Job 14:13. Job speaks himself. He considers himself righteous. Oh, that you would hide me in Sheol, that you would keep me secret until your wrath is past. And this is not uncommon elsewhere in Scripture. Jacob in Genesis speaks of going down to Sheol. Hezekiah in Isaiah speaks of going down to Sheol. And they both considered themselves to be righteous, and the Scripture pictures them as righteous. The righteous are there. In fact, everybody that is dead is there. And this is indicated, I think, in both Job and elsewhere. Job 30:23. For I know that you will bring me to death, to the house appointed for all living. That does not actually use the phrase Sheol there, notice, to death, but suggests everybody heads there. It seems there's certainly some parallel. Maybe I should mention that there are about, out of these 65 occurrences, there must be a third of them anyway, are in poetic sections where Sheol is in parallelism to death in some way. The word death or pit or something of that sort is used in parallel to it. So Job hints, certainly at least, that all are in Sheol, and the Psalm 89:48 comes right out and says so. Psalm 89:48. What man is he that lives and shall not see death? Shall he deliver his soul from the hand of Sheol? Shall he deliver his soul from the hand of Sheol? So the place is down in some kind of terminology. It is hidden. It can be spoken of as Jonah being there, even though he's still in the belly of a whale. Both the wicked and the righteous are there. In fact, everybody that dies, of course, everybody that dies falls in one of the categories, is there. So it's a place of all dead. Well, let's look at some of the conditions in Sheol. Sudden entry. That's remarked on in Job. Job 21:13. Talking about the wicked. Job says in verse 7, why do the wicked live, become old, are mighty in power? Their seed, their descendants are established in their sight. Their houses are safe from fear. The rod of God beating them is not upon them. Their bull genders and doesn't fail. Their cow calves and doesn't cast her calf. They send forth their little ones like a flock, etc. They spend their days in wealth. All that sounds pretty good. And in a moment go down to Sheol. Now, then right after that, verse 14, therefore they say to God. So their moment going down to Sheol is not a bad thing in a sense. Maybe it will be when they get there. But the point is, they die suddenly. He's talking about there are rich people who have it good all this life, and they don't even die of lingering cancer or something. Something happens suddenly, they die in their sleep or something. You know, it's a very nice, quick death. So go down suddenly to Sheol. Therefore, they say to God, scram, we aren't interested in you. I mean, wicked people who have seemed to have had it good all their life, and they seem to be confident when they died, and they died quickly and easily. He's looking at the lesson that people learn from seeing such things happen. They say, what do we need with God? Why should we postulate this idea of God? We don't seem to see that all the wicked getting all they deserve. He's not saying all the wicked get all right as well, of course, but pointing that way. So quick entry to Sheol. And it's not pictures of anything bad right there. It's not saying what looks like to the guy who does it. He's saying what looks like to the guy who's watching it and drawing the conclusion, therefore they say to God, depart from me. Chapter 27, I think, 19 to 21. The wealthy one lies down, but he's not gathered. He opens his eyes, and he is not. Notice that peculiar phrase again. Sudden terrors will overtake him like waters. At night, a wind will carry him off. An east wind will pick him up, and he will go, and it will sweep him away from his place. Here we perhaps see the inside view of what it looks like in one of these nice, peaceful, quiet deaths. But the idea, again, is a quick departure to Sheol, which is all I'm trying to get across here. Sudden entry. I think these two passages in Job explain perhaps what is meant by several passages elsewhere that use the idea of being swallowed up alive by Sheol. Let's look at a few of those. They're rather peculiar passages. Numbers chapter 16 is perhaps the best known one. Numbers chapter 16, verses 30 and 33. The rebellion of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, trying to put down Moses, Aaron, etc. Moses says, he calls out all of these rebels, and Moses says, hereby you will know that the Lord has sent me to do all these works. Numbers 16:28. For I have not done them of my own mind. If these men die the common death of all men, or if they be visited after the visitation of all men, then the Lord has not sent me. If the way they die is the way everybody dies, then I am no prophet. But if the Lord will cause a new type of thing to happen, if the earth will open its mouth and swallow them up with all that belongs to them, and they go down alive to the pit, then you shall understand that these men have provoked the Lord. And it came to pass, as he made an end of speaking all these words, that the ground split open under them. The earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up, and their household goods, and their household, and all the men that pertained to Korah, and all their goods. They and all that went with them went down alive to the pit. The earth closed upon them, and they perished from among the congregation. That passage would appear, again, to be a passage that says, well, Sheol's a hole down there somewhere, and this opened up and gave them an express route down there, something of that sort. Indeed, something happened that was not normal. That's what Moses says. If these people die the normal way, I'm not from God. But if something strange happens and the earth opens up and they disappear very quickly, then that's something else. So the question, of course, would be then whether going down alive to the pit and being swallowed up by the earth are entirely synonymous, or whether they're two things that happened at the same time. They fell into a hole in the ground and they died and went straight to Sheol, rather than they fell in a hole in the ground and landed alive in Sheol. Now, first, it would seem that the suggestion that this is really a hole in the ground where Sheol is, and this was just a hidden entrance that was opened to it suddenly, a trap door of some sort, would seem to be a reasonable understanding of this passage. But if we look at a couple other passages that use the same phrase, it would suggest to me that the two are not identical, that the falling of the hole is the way they got killed, and the going down to Sheol is a result of them getting killed. Let's look at Psalm 55:15. This is a psalm of David, and he's praying because he is oppressed by enemies. "Give ear to my prayer, O God," he says. "Hide not yourself from my supplication. Because the voice of my enemy, the voice of the oppression, because of the oppression of the wicked, for they cast iniquity upon me, and wrath they hate me. Oh, that I had wings like a dove, for then I would fly away and be at rest," etc. And then coming down to our verse 15, he speaks of his wicked enemies. "Let death seize upon them, let them go down alive into Sheol, for wickedness is in their dwelling and among them. As for me, I will call upon God, and the Lord will deliver me, will save me." So here, he's speaking in a context which has nothing to do with Korah and Dathan and Abiram anyway. And he says, let Sheol swallow them up alive. Now, is he praying that God will open a hole to let these people in it? Or is he merely praying that God will cause them to die suddenly, that they will no longer impede the Lord's work and will no longer heap abuse upon David? Well, it's not clear here, but it certainly opens the idea that this reference back in Numbers is not, when it says being swallowed up alive by Sheol, that's not just referring to the falling into the hole, but that's referring to a sudden death, and the falling into the hole is something else which causes it, of course, but it's not definitely connected. Now, there's a reference again in Proverbs, the only other time this phrase occurs, which I think pushes even more in this direction than I've been suggesting, that swallowed up alive by Sheol means a sudden death. And that is in Proverbs 1:12. Proverbs 1:12. "My son," says Solomon, "if sinners entice you, do not consent to it. If they say," and now we have a long quotation of what the sinners will say to encourage the fellow being talked to here. "If they say, come with us, and let us lay in wait for blood. Let us lurk secretly for the innocent without cause," not vengeance, in other words. "Let us swallow them up alive like Sheol, and whole like those that go down to the pit. We shall find all precious substance. We shall fill our house with spoil. Cast in your lot among us. Let us have one purse," unquote. That's their whole proposal. "We're going to have a common operation. We're going to waylay people out in the sticks or at night in their houses. We'll make a lot of money out of it, and we'll pool it all together, and such. We'll be rich. And let us swallow them up alive like Sheol." Well, he's talking about the thieves catching the people before they know what happened to them, and either killing them or perhaps not even killing them, but catching them and getting them in power before they know what's happening so that they can carry all the goods. And he says, swallow them up like Sheol and whole like those that go down to the pit. Impression is everyday occurrence, that people are swallowed up alive by Sheol. That's the only way you're ever swallowed up by death, is alive. Huh? But it means a sudden death. I think it doesn't mean any kind of death. It means a sudden death. And phrase, sudden death, you see. And we're going to be sudden death to these guys. We're going to grab them before they knew what hit them, just like death does to a lot of people. And then we'll carry off their goods. We'd now like to look at a third area connected with conditions. And that is, under conditions. No activity, or limited activity is a better term to use. Limited activity in Sheol. No activity is a bit strong, although that's the way I've got it worded in my notes here. limited activity in Sheol. Principal passage in Job for this is the one we looked at earlier, Job chapter 3, verses 13 through 19. Job 3, verses 13 through 19. Now would have laid down and been at rest, would have slept and been at rest with all these different kinds of people. There the wicked cease from turmoil. There the exhausted rest from labor. There the prisoners are at ease. They don't hear the voice of the slave driver. The slave is freed from his master. An end, at least, of certain types of earthly activity. And the figure used through here is pretty much a rest, peace sort of idea. In Psalm chapter 6, we see the same idea. We go outside of Job. Psalm 6, verse 5. In death there is no remembrance of thee. In the grave, who will give you thanks? In Sheol, that would be, who will give you thanks? The regular activities of this life, praise, worship, something about remembering, don't seem to be operating in Sheol. Now, whether that's an absolute cutoff, hard to say. But some restriction in those areas seem to be pictured. Psalm 31, verse 17. Let the wicked be ashamed and let them be silent in Sheol. Let them be silent in Sheol. Ecclesiastes 9, 10, I think, is probably the classic passage for this particular thrust. Whatever your hand finds to do, Ecclesiastes 9, 10, do it with your strength. For there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in Sheol, where you are going. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your strength, do it with your might, because you won't do it in Sheol. At least certain aspects of the activity in this life won't be going on in Sheol, so do them now. So that certainly is pointed out in Ecclesiastes. And I think that's the thrust I'm trying to get here. Not that there's no activity. There is a limitation of activity in some very serious way in this place of the party dead. And pictured rather strongly in some places, perhaps more weakly in other places. Apparently, man was made to have a body and doesn't in Sheol in some way. That's not to say there may not be something more complicated about the soul than we imagine. You think again of the rich man and Lazarus and the tongue burning and wanting to come dip your finger in water and put it on my tongue and such. We're really at sea when we try and figure out how much of that is figurative and how much isn't, because we haven't been there. But there's something different about the situation, and people are not able to do what they were created to be able to do in their own bodies, which man was created to have a body. He will always have a body in the resurrection, as we'll see later. And so this is an unnatural state, and it's an unnatural state produced by sin, that there is even a place of the dead that men go to. So some of it, I think, is hinted at here in this very great restriction of activity, which may not be an absolute no activity, but a great restriction. We see, for instance, Pharaoh seeing things and being satisfied, and occasionally remarks being made back and forth, as we see in the New Testament, but a great restriction of some sort. There's some kind of destruction connected with Sheol, and here you get into the very serious problem of separating what is the grave and what is, in other words, what's happening to the body in the earth and what's happening to the person in Sheol. And I don't know for sure how to sort those, and therefore I'm not going to be able to give you a very good picture. But this phrase Sheol is used with the idea of destruction rather frequently. Back in Job, we find Job 17:13 is a good representative passage of this sort. My days are past, he says in verse 11, Job 17. My purpose is broken off, even the thoughts of my heart. They change the night into day. The light is short because of darkness. If I wait, the grave is my house. I have made my bed in darkness. I have said to corruption, you're my father. To the worm, you're my mother and my sister. Where now is my hope? As for my hope, who shall see it? They shall go down to the bars of the pit when our rest together is in the dust. Passage there. Some kind of corruption is going on. And yet it's not clear that that's in Sheol. That might just be in the grave. That may just be the body rotting in the grave. The grave is my house. I've made my bed in darkness. I said to corruption, you are my father, etc. So some kind of destruction involved there, but that might just be the grave. 24:19, this one the King James translators understood it was the grave. It's a little difficult to tell. We've looked at this one already once before. 24:19 in Job. Drought and heat consume the snow waters. So does Sheol, those who have sinned. So does Sheol, those who have sinned. Some kind of consuming destruction involved. Is that, again, just the body consumed in the grave? Is it something else that's happening to the person in his intermediate state? It's not made clear. Not made clear there. Let's look at some of the other passages in Scripture which refer to Sheol also, outside of Job, and see those. And again, we have a similar problem. Psalm 16:10. We understand from the New Testament that this is a reference to Jesus in the grave. You will not leave my soul in Sheol, neither will you suffer your Holy One to see corruption. Connection of corruption in Sheol again. But they're apparently having to do with the grave, since we have light on that from the New Testament. So that may well be the grave. The two places we looked at in Job may well be the grave. Psalm 49:14. Talking about a man being greatly honored. Psalm 49:11. Their inward thought is that their houses shall continue forever, their dwelling place to all generations. They'll call their lands after their own names, etc. This their way, he says in verse 13, is their folly, yet their posterity approve their sayings. Like sheep, they are laid in the grave. Death shall feed upon them. The upright shall have dominion over them in the morning. Their beauty shall consume in the grave from their dwelling. Again, is it the grave? Is it some departed place of the soul? It's not entirely clear. There is some destruction involved, and that we can understand very clearly how that would be in the grave. And from New Testament, I think we can also understand that how that could be in the place of departed wicked. We might wonder how it could be in a place of departed righteous, however. But so far, nothing has been said explicitly that would require either one in these passages. And that may be something that we learn more about as Revelation continues. Two more passages to look at. Proverbs 15, verse 11. Sheol and destruction are before the Lord. How much more than the hearts of the children of men? This is talking about some invisible place, apparently, because it's telling you how God can see the invisible. He can see into the hearts of men. He can see Sheol and destruction. It puts the two in a parallelism. That might seem that there's some kind of destruction connected with the hidden place of the dead. It's doubtful that it's just talking about the grave. Because why would it say how much more the hearts of men? It seems to be an argument from the greater to the lesser. If God can see the place of the departed dead, how much easier can he see the hearts of men? But that wouldn't make sense if God can see in the grave how much more he can see the hearts of men. Because men can see in the grave, just come out at night and dig a hole, and stick your lantern down and look around, see? It seems to be a lesser to the greater argument, and that seems to suggest that there is a use of the phrase destruction in parallel with Sheol. Some kind of destruction goes on. Does it go on for everybody, or does it just go on for the wicked? Doesn't say. But here it seems that this passage would point to an idea that there is some kind of destruction connected with the spiritual place, but it doesn't say whether everybody that's there is involved in it. Isaiah 14:11 is the last passage we'll look at. These are not exhaustive treatments of these material at all. I'm sure you realize that, but I'll remind you again. This one looks very much like a grave remark. This is talking about the king of Babylon, as we see in verse 4, Isaiah 14:4, Isaiah 14:11, your pomp, your majesty, is brought down to the grave, and the noise of your viols. The worm is spread under you, and the worms cover you. That sounds rather like the grave there. Seems here that, again, we're talking about the grave. But out of all of those passages, Proverbs 15:11 looks like the only one that seems to point to the spiritual abode definitely. The others are possible. This one seems to be rather definite and has some kind of destruction involved there. So far, sudden entry, a limitation of activity, some kind of destruction, but not clear what the range of it is. Lastly, no escape. No escape. Job 7, verses 9 and 10. Clouds waste away and depart, so the one descending into Sheol will not come up. He will not return again to his house, nor will he again know his place. Sounds very absolute. One could say, this means there is no getting out of Sheol, period, and one will never come back. possible to understand it that way, and then argue that that's a contradiction with other passages in other places in Job. My suggestion here is that that's saying there's no escape. When you say there's no escape from a prison, that does not mean somebody can't let you out. It means the guy can't get out from inside. Doesn't mean the jailer can't come down and unlock a door and let you out. I mean, you can't get out. That's my suggestion, that Sheol is set up in such a way nobody inside it can get themselves out. They're stuck. They're stuck. They have no way to do that. And suggestion here, Job 7, verses 9 and 10, among several other places, no escape. No escape. And that is not just something that's found only in Job. That's found elsewhere in the Old Testament. We look at one passage, Psalm 89, 48. Psalm 89, 48. What man is he that lives and shall not see death? Shall he deliver his soul from the hand of Sheol, or from the power, the literal way in his hand? Shall he rescue his own soul from the power of Sheol? Implied answer, no. No, he won't. He will not rescue himself. Now, I think there's something more than that. I think these have been understood by liberals to be the early view that there's no getting out of Sheol at all. I don't think that's correct. I think it says there is no getting out for the person inside. He can't get himself out. And we'll see why I think that as we come into the next Roman numeral, 4, resurrection. Resurrection. And the reason why there's no escape is you can't resurrect yourself. God can resurrect a person, but the person cannot resurrect himself. Except for one exception, and that is the one person who has ever existed who is both a created being and also God. But that's a huge exception, of course, and we'll not get into that. Resurrection in Job. Well, let's look at two Job passages. One of them we've looked at already. I want to bring you back to it again. Job 14. And we could take the whole 7 through 15 passage we were looking at before. My suggestion as we got into some there, I hadn't intended to get into it that much that early, is that the figure of the tree sprouting again, and an implied figure in the water which evaporates, but does not cease to exist, and which comes back down again, and is visible again as rainwater later, that these two figures, which are what are used in connection with this, at least suggest to Job possibility of living again, coming back. Does not seem to have any view in his mind that he'll cease to exist when he dies. So he's apparently thinking here of something beyond that. It is not clear whether he fully understood that that would come to pass or not. But we're not arguing that everybody in the Old Testament knew everything that you could figure out from the New Testament. We're suggesting that what they did know was not inconsistent with what is the case, and they had not been told everything about it. The suggestion here in Job 14 is this is consistent with a resurrection. And Job is asking that that happen, that he be allowed to be hidden in Sheol. My suggestion here is he's asking for a quick death, that he knows that he will go die and go to Sheol, and that he does feel he will come back again, but he'd like to do it now. He does not enjoy the suffering, and that's fairly obvious through the whole material. There's another passage, however, that I think is a good deal stronger, and that's in Job 19. Job 19, verses 25 through 27. And if we'll turn over and have a look at that then, I've got own translation from the Hebrew, and then compared with two recent translations of the Bible, the New English Bible and the Revised Standard Version of the Bible, both made by basically liberal men. One of them, RSV, is attempt to be a fairly literal translation, and the New English Bible is a paraphrase, basically admitted to be paraphrastic by the men who made it. However, it's much more than just a paraphrase. It is what you might call wishful thinking, in my opinion. An attempt to reconstruct the text in ways that would be desired. And I think it shows up rather clearly in this particular passage. We look at the Hebrew. This is a difficult passage in the Hebrew. Job 19, verses 25, 26, and 27. Although most of it is quite clear. I myself know that my Goel, a kinsman redeemer, lives. A kinsman redeemer was a person who did one of two things. He rescued his relatives from poverty by laying out money to get their land back when they had to sell it when they were poor, or he took vengeance on somebody who had killed one of his relatives by going out and killing the guy that killed him and pursuing him until he might catch up with him or get out of range or get into a city of refuge or something of that sort. this would presumably go back before the cities of refuge, a kinsman, either a redeemer, one who rescues you from poverty, or one who avenges your death. I myself know that my redeemer lives, and later, or finally, it's a broad term, he shall stand upon the dust, or arise upon the dust, is the Hebrew there. And then we come to a very tricky phrase, and after my skin they have struck off this. What on earth does that mean? Well, I don't know. Maybe after they have struck off this my skin, or something of that sort, you'll notice the Revised Standard, which tries to be as literal as it can, takes the this to mean thus, after my skin has been thus destroyed. We'll look in a moment what the New English Bible is doing here. After my skin they have struck off this, it seems to be the skin is fouled up in some way. Even from my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold and not another, my kidneys having been destroyed in my bosom. Wait, it seems to read the Hebrew. King James is really quite close to this most of the way. Now that's a tricky thing. Does it mean in or outside? It could mean either. It's a funny word. From, if you say, I saw him from my house, you would normally mean inside. I saw the car go by from my house. It could conceivably mean outside. That's not the most common use, but it can be found examples outside. You'll see the RSV has, not in parentheses, they have in a footnote, then from my flesh, or then without my flesh, I'll see God. How do you solve a problem when the range of meaning of the word can allow either? By the context. Only way to solve it? Then maybe you've not got enough information to solve it there. We'll look in a moment whether you've got enough information in the context to solve that. I think you do, but let's see. Job here is talking of some person, being, whom he calls his redeemer, his vindicator. He's alive. Both of these translations, both the New English Bible and the RSV, seem to understand he's talking about God. The NEB brings in this phrase, vindicator, which doesn't quite seem to fall on top of the meaning of either of the other two. Vindicator certainly would make good sense if you mean the avenger. That could be used that way. But you find out very quickly that the NEB has a court scene constructed here. Look through the way they've handled it here. They've got a court scene. My vindicator lives, and he will rise last to speak in court. I shall discern my witness standing at my side, and see my defending counsel, even God himself, whom I shall see with my own eyes, etc. The NEB has worked it rather cleverly so that, one, you don't see anybody's flesh wiping out, and so it doesn't even seem to try and picture continued existence of the individual beyond death. There doesn't seem to be anything mentioned about death. Just seems to say, well, God is going to vindicate me. He will act like my defending counsel, like my witness. He'll stand up in court, etc. It makes very good sense the way they've constructed it. It doesn't fit particularly any of the other biblical passages. It does fit very nicely, by the way, the view of evolution of religion, that here you're not picturing some life after death or something, which they would like not to think exists in Job. The only problem is, it doesn't follow the Hebrew. I'm not a great Hebraist, so I can't tell you exactly what they've done. There are a number of passages. You just find words there in the Hebrew, which are perfectly ordinary words in Hebrew. You look them up, see the range of meaning that they have, and the information we have, and none of these fall in. None of the words they've used fall into that range. Now, if you know Hebrew really well, you can search around and look for words that look vaguely like it and see if any of those have any resemblance. And you find some that do, that look vaguely like it. Let me read you a passage from an article by Dr. McCrae on the New English Bible Old Testament, which he concentrates on this one passage and says several things about it. The phrase, in my heart, you see there in the first line of the NEB, is inserted without any warrant in the Hebrew Bible. Doesn't occur. Where the King James Version says redeemer, the New English Bible substitutes vindicator. It's the Hebrew word's a participle, which occurs rather frequently, discusses the kinsman redeemer sort of thing. And aside from this verse, the New English Bible never translates this word by vindicator or by any similar word. Only place they translate it that way. There seemed to be no escape from the conclusion as far as the word is concerned. The New English Bible translators have chosen to insert in this passage an idea of their own to discard completely the meaning of the original Hebrew. The next section regarding he shall rise last to speak in court, he says, while a phrase translated in King James Version, he shall stand at the last, could equally be rendered he will rise last as in the New English Bible. This is not true of the following words, to speak in court, which have no foundation in the original Hebrew. No phrase, to speak in court. The in court and even to speak have been put in. To get speak in court out of the phrase upon dust requires a great effort of imagination. There is no Hebrew at this point that is ever translated elsewhere as to speak or that has anything to do with a court. The idea of the whole courtroom scene is based entirely upon imagination in the Bible translators. The words in the King James Version, after my skin, which is I've also translated that way in my translation here, are translated in New English Bible, I shall discern my witness. There is no Hebrew basis for translating after into I shall discern. By changing one vowel and one consonant of the word my skin, we can obtain a Hebrew word which means my witness. So you change one thing, it goes back before the time of Christ, and another thing, it goes back some centuries after. Such a change can hardly be called a translation. It is as if one were to change the W in the English word now into a T, not now to not, without even a footnote to explain what had been done. Where the King James literally translates the Hebrew words that mean they destroy this, the New English Bible writes standing at my side. In order to do this, it's necessary to remove the first consonant of the second Hebrew word and place it in the middle of the first word. Take it out of the second word, put it in the middle of the first word. And then to change the vowels all around. It is somewhat as if the words, the book, were to be changed into he baked. Even after this is done, the New English Bible translation is still unwarranted. The verb produced by this juggling is one that occurs only twice in the Old Testament, and in both instances is translated straightened, or straightens in the New English Bible, and doesn't have anything to do with raised up. Hard to see how it could be standing by my side. It's straightened, and yet standing by my side. When the King James Version translates Hebrew word in my flesh, New English Bible reads, my defending counsel. By changing the vowels of this word, one can obtain a word that means the one bringing good tidings to me. That, however, would scarcely warrant the translation my defending counsel, which represents a quite different idea. So he goes on some. But what you see really here is something that is not too rare in the New English Bible with the little experience I've had in it. Read about halfway through the Old Testament now, and very frequent that they move verses around, and those you can tell because they have to move the number around to tell you where the verse went, but move phrases around in a verse, move vowels and consonants around in a Hebrew text, or assume meanings of words in a Hebrew text that are not there. There's a great deal of that in the New English Bible. I would say if a person does not know Hebrew very thoroughly, he would not do well to study the scripture out of the New English Bible. Or he'd have for a reference work to see what's going on, although it's hard to tell what's going on when you read it. You only find out what they decided they thought it meant, and you don't know why they decided that's what it meant. As far as I can tell, they have gotten into a position where they feel the meaning of the Hebrew at certain passages does not make sense to them, although it often makes good sense to us, and therefore they feel they will arbitrarily correct the text by assuming it originally was written some other way, and then translate it. And they translate fairly freely after that even. So this, I think, is a good passage to show you the divergence you can get. The Hebrew is very closely translated by the King James Version, and the New English Bible has done a great deal of diddling with the material to get the result they obtained. The RSV, which is translated by liberal men, but on a idea that they would stick very close to the text and not make modifications in the text, produces something that looks very much like the King James Version if you compare the RSV with the KJV. And does have your skin being destroyed, and then the person is still doing something after that happens. So it certainly requires survival, it's the survival of the individual. And then what we really need to seriously look at is, does it imply resurrection? Does it imply resurrection? Well, how do you decide that? If you have to hang it all on the from, whether that means from my body meaning inside, or from my body meaning outside, you can't tell. Is it a passage that says, well, there's my body wiped out over there in the grave, but me outside, I will see my vindicator standing upon the earth? Possible understanding, but does it fit the parallelism of the passage? The writer makes a pretty big case, whom I will see for myself, and my eyes shall behold, and not another. Well, that's a fairly good trick. My eyes shall behold and not another. How does his eyes behold if he's outside his flesh? Well, maybe he took his eyes with him. But suggestion here, His body has been destroyed. He says that. After my skin, they have struck off this. And the last line, as I've understood it, my kidneys having been destroyed in my bosom. His body has been destroyed. But after that time, from my flesh, in my flesh, I will see God, whom I'll see for myself, and my eyes shall behold, and not another's eyes. My eyes shall behold. The suggestion, the flesh has been destroyed, the flesh has been reorganized, and he sees it from the flesh. Suggestion then, that this is a resurrection passage, and that the parallelism supports it. That the parallelism we're arguing for here is not a parallelism that the body was never destroyed, so we expect body-destroying passages being involved there. But we also expect that if this is talking about resurrection, that there's reference to the body being used to see with, and the use of the eyes, and my eye shall see for myself. That's a strong emphasis there in Hebrew. And my eye shall behold and not another. He makes about 3 points in there, even without the from my flesh, that seem to thrust it. It's he that's doing the seeing, and it's his eyes and not somebody else's that are doing the seeing. And suggests then a new body. So the body was destroyed, he's got a new one. And he sees his vindicator standing upon the earth. Right? Not down in Sheol, standing upon the earth, upon the dust. The dust he's sitting in, presumably, the dust and ashes. And he's out in the garbage heap here, if you recall from the setting of Job. Those are the Job passages. They don't beat you over the head with resurrection, but they're consistent with it. They're consistent with it. And the parallelism and the figures make better sense in a resurrection sense than they do in some other kind. And you can see the liberals are bothered by it. They wouldn't have gone to the trouble they'd gone in the New English Bible to remove this material if they didn't think there was some problem with it being there. They do think there's some problem with it being there. According to the article in the Theological Word Book of the New Testament, Theological Dictionary of the New Testament, they're not supposed to have believed in resurrection this early. Not supposed to come in until the time of Isaiah. But here's a passage that seems to point that way. The RSV has a footnote. Maybe it's outside my body, but leaves that as a footnote, because that's not the common meaning of men. The NEB tries to make the whole passage unnoticed, which it would be to anybody having that only to read. You'd never get the faintest idea anything about even death is mentioned in the whole passage. But it is. In Hebrew, it's there.
Biblical Theological Seminary is happy to have brought you this study in God's Word. We minister to people through our graduate and postgraduate degree programs, our community evening school, our cassette ministry, special seminars, and a free publication, Biblical Bulletin, containing interesting articles by biblical faculty members. For a free cassette catalog or more information about the seminary, please write to Biblical Theological Seminary, 200 North Main Street, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, zip code 19440.